But anyway, beginning with verse 1 of chapter 48 of Psalms, it says, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, his holy mountain. Beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great king. God in her palaces has made himself known as a stronghold. For lo, the kings assembled themselves, they passed by together, they saw it, then they were amazed, they were terrified, they fled in alarm. Panic seized them there, anguish as of a woman in childbirth. With the east wind, you break the ships of Tarshish. As we have heard, so we have seen in the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God. God will establish her forever. We have thought on your loving kindness, O God, in the midst of your temple. As in your name, O God, so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion be glad. Let the daughters of Judah rejoice because of your judgments. Walk about Zion and go around her. Count her towers. Consider her ramparts. Go through her palaces that you might tell it to the next generation. For such is God, our God, forever and ever. He will guide us until death." Now, I just want to back up here. It's only 14 verses, but reading it, it almost seems like it's got some disjointed themes to this, but it's really not. You just tie it all together and see what is being said here. It really covers a lot of ground. And it's talking about Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And it's basically talking about when he returns, when he sets up his millennial kingdom, when he is ruling and reigning on this earth. That's what it's really pointing to. This is really prophetic in regards to his millennial reign, because if you back up to that verse 1, it says this: "Great is the Lord, greatly to be praised, in the city of our God, his holy mountain." Now, I mean, this is something I really see that's being lost today, mm-hmm. especially today. So often, people are manufacturing a kind of a God in their own image and likeness, in terms of we like to manufacture a God that's more comfortable to be around, that's more to our liking. And when we do that, we really unconsciously bring God down to our level. And unless we really have a high opinion of God, I don't think that we're ever going to come into a proper relationship with him. I really don't. Because people, they don't get it when it comes to our need to elevate God, to exalt him, to recognize that he is the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the God of Gods, and he's not to be trifled with, and he's to be revered, and he's to be feared. Now, when I say feared, John tells us, he says that perfect love drives out all fear. But that fear is translated in, you know what, we're going to have to account to him someday, and we're going to have to stand before him in judgment. And I don't care whether you're saved or you're lost. That is the bottom line, is we're going to have to stand before this great king. And I tell you, people have lost sight of that, you know, recognizing that we are going to have to account to God someday for our life. And that's what that fear of the Lord is. But if we are obeying God, and we're living for him, and we revere him, then we have no need to fear him. That's what people have to understand. But he says, "Great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God, his holy mountain." Many years ago, I heard this pastor say that he had a group, probably like this, where they were just having kind of a Bible study and just sharing about the Lord. And then the pastor just threw out this question, says, "What would you do if Jesus Christ walked into this room right now? What do you think you would do, and what do you think you would say?" And then it kind of went around the room, and people said, you know, various things, but then came to one woman, you know, sitting over on a couch, and she said, "Well, if he came in here right now, I'd say, hey, Jesus, why don't you come on over here and give me a kiss?" Mm. Now, that kind of thing, it's like, it just lacks a total sense of reverence, doesn't it? Mm. It's like it's a familiarity that can breed contempt right at the very altar of God. And people don't see that what we're dealing with here is a great king. We are really dealing with the God of Gods, the Lord of Lords, the King of Kings. And people, I'm telling you, I see it all the time. And I'm not trying to be anybody's judge, because I got to stand before God like everybody else. But, you know, God has made himself abundantly clear on so many issues, so many issues. And yet we have just so manufactured God in such a way that we want to be basically... we want to live our life the way we want to live it and have a God that we're very comfortable with. And I'll just give you an example, and believe me, I'm not picking on this group. I'm not. Just this past week in the papers, and it's all over the news, the CEO of Apple Computer, all right, I won't even mention his name, you know, he's come out of the closet, says he's gay and all this, and I read it in Time Magazine, I read it in USA Today, that was in other papers too. And he just came out and says, being a gay is the greatest gift that God has ever given me. Now, to me, it's like, wait a minute. What are you doing here? You're taking God and bringing him down to your level. See, this is why when you read a verse like this, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised in the city of our God and in his holy mountain. Like I said, I'm not picking on any group at all. I'm just simply saying, man, what's wrong with people that they don't see that this God needs to be revered and he needs to be obeyed and he needs to be feared in terms of doing what he says. Mm-hmm. But people will say, well, that's the Old Testament, man. Get the heck out of there. I'm more comfortable with God in the New Testament. Well, but here's the thing, and I was just sharing this in another Bible study that I talked about on Tuesday morning, but, you know, this is what Jesus Christ said to the church of Laodicea. Now, he addressed seven different churches, and five of them were in need of repentance. And he says this to this church that he has absolutely nothing positive to say about this church. He says, I know your deeds, that you are neither cold nor hot. I wish that you were cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spit you or literally vomit you out of my mouth, because you say, I am rich and I become wealthy and I have need of nothing. And you do not know that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. I advise you to buy from me gold refined by fire, so that you may become rich, and white garments, so that you may clothe yourself, and that the shame of your nakedness will not be revealed, and I swab to anoint your eyes so that you may see. Those whom I love I reprove and discipline, therefore be zealous and repent. Now, that's what I'm saying. When we read something like this, this is God speaking. This is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And, you know, he's coming across as someone who is anything but indifferent in regards to our relationship with him and how we interact with him. And these people here, he had absolutely nothing positive. But if you look at all these other churches, even the ones that he rebuked, mm-hmm. he finds something positive. Mm-hmm. He finds something to commend. But this church, he didn't. I once heard a story about this woman. She was the type of woman, she never said a negative thing about anybody. Everybody, she would always say something positive about. You know, regardless of how obnoxious the person may be, or about how many character flaws they have, or how difficult they may be to get along with, she always had something positive to say. These two guys were talking about it one day, and he says, you know, Mary, she has nothing but positive things to say about everyone. And the guy says, you know, I'll bet you $20 she could say something positive about the devil. And the other guy says, well, you're wrong. There's no way she's going to find something positive to say about the devil. So they go up to her and say, hey, Mary, can you say anything positive about the devil? And she says, well, he's a very, very, very hard worker.
Yeah, I'm sure he is. Yeah.
Well, this woman could find something positive to say about the devil, but Jesus Christ didn't find anything positive to say about this church, right? And what was this church? Look at it. It says that they think to themselves, that, hey, man, there's nothing wrong with me. He says this, because you say, I am rich, and I become wealthy, and I need nothing, and you do not know that you are wretched and miserable, poor, blind, and naked. Now, those are Jesus Christ's words. This is what he says, that you don't know that you are wretched and miserable and poor and blind and naked. And I'm telling you, when we read a verse like this in chapter 48 of Psalms, when it says, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, we have to elevate him. We really do. We have to put him up there where we recognize, you know, yes, God, he wants a personal relationship with us. He wants to connect with us. He wants this interaction with us. And he's a God of forgiveness, a God of love, a God of compassion, a God of mercy, and all of these things. But I'll tell you what, he's nobody's fool, and he's not a God to be trifled with. All right, I really think that we should show him this kind of respect. And then he says in that verse 2, beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great king. God in her palaces, he has made himself known as a stronghold. Now he's talking about, and when he says in that verse 2, beautiful in elevation, the joy of the whole earth is Mount Zion in the far north, the city of the great king. Now, he's talking about Jerusalem here, mm-hmm. but it has its fulfillment when? It's going to have its fulfillment in the millennial period, but it's also going to have its ultimate fulfillment when?
The New Jerusalem comes out of heaven.
Yeah, yeah, the New Jerusalem, where you know, this is going to be a fulfillment of what it says in Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 through 4. It says this, "And I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and there was no longer any sea. And I saw the holy city, the New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is among men, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and God himself will be among them, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death, and there will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away." And he also goes on to say this in this chapter 21 of Revelation. It says this, "And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain, and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, and having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, as a stone of crystal clear of jasper." And he says it had a great and high wall, and it describes the city. It's saying it's 1,500 miles high, it's 1,500 miles wide, it's 1,500 miles long. This city is just absolutely massive. And it goes on to say in this Revelation chapter 21 about this city, when it describes the foundation stones, it describes the gates, and then it says this, "And I saw no temple in it, for the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple, and the city has no need of the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of God has illuminated it, and its lamp is the Lamb. And nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. In the daytime, for there will be no night there, the gates will never be closed, and they will bring the glory and the honor of the nations into it. And nothing unclean and no one who practices abominations and lying shall ever come into it, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life." That's going to be this ultimate fulfillment of this great city. But I don't know, I think I may have mentioned here before, that it says here there's going to be no night. And we are told in Titus that there's going to, when Paul in his salutation, he says, till the end of time is how he addressed it. And I've talked about it before, that time is going to end. Time itself is a creation of God. And we are told in Revelation chapter 20 that there's coming a day when this whole universe is going to disappear from the face of him who sits upon the throne. He's going to end. He's going to make a new heavens and a new earth. And then there's no longer going to be any time, because we'll be dwelling in eternity, dwelling with God, because God dwells in eternity. This is a concept that is very difficult for us to wrap our minds around, because to us, everything has a beginning. Everything has an end. And my point is this, you can't separate space and time. What to me was most fascinating about it is that time had a beginning, and that time is going to have an end, and that time is a creation of the Almighty. You would think it always existed. No, you know, God dwells in eternity. Time is tied up in our cosmos, in our universe, and God is going to do away with it, and then he's going to create this new heavens and new earth, and he dwells in eternity, but we're going to dwell with him in this city. And time is totally irrelevant, because you go back to Genesis chapter 1 and 2, we read about God's creation of the universe. It says, "And there was evening and morning the first day, evening and morning the second day, evening and morning the third day, evening and morning the sixth day." Right? Right down the line. Well, I just read there in Revelations that there's no longer going to be any night. The time is going to be gone. So when we read stuff like this, it's so easy to just go, "Well, yeah, well, yawn. What does that mean?" But man, if you really begin to break it down, really begin to analyze it, what does it mean? If this is where the city of the great king is going to be, and it's going to have its ultimate fulfillment in this new Jerusalem. But before that happens, look at this verse 4, 5, and 6. And 7, it says this, "For lo, the kings assembled themselves, they passed by together, they saw it, and then they were amazed, and they were terrified, they fled in alarm, panic seized them there, anguish as of a woman in childbirth. With the east wind, you break the ships of Tarshish." Now, like I said, you read that, you say, well, what's the connection here? But there is a connection. What is the connection? Because we're talking about the city of the great king here. We're talking about ultimately there being a new Jerusalem. But he throws this in there.
There's going to come a point where the kings of the earth go against Jerusalem.
Well, see, this is the thing. Before this new city, there's going to be where Christ returns with great power, great glory. That's when he's going to do what? That's when he's going to put down these armies. That's when he's going to put down everyone who refuses to make Jesus Christ their king. Yeah, this is what it says in Revelation 19. It says, I saw the heavens open, and behold, a white horse, and he who sat upon it is called faithful and true, and in righteousness he judges and wages war. And his eyes are a flame of fire, and on his head are many diadems, and he has a name written on him which no one knows except himself, and he is clothed in a robe dipped in blood. And his name is called the Word of God, and the armies which are in heaven, clothed in fine linen, white and clean, were following him on white horses, and from his mouth comes a sharp sword, so that with it he may strike down the nations, and that he will rule them with a rod of iron, and he treads the winepress of the fierce wrath of God the Almighty. And on his robe and on his thigh he has a name written, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. We're just reading right here, great is the Lord and greatly to be praised, and he is this God to be revered. But he's going to put down all those who are at war with him. And then all those who are at war with him, they got a special judgment coming, because this is what it says. Continue on in this Revelation chapter 19. He says this, then I saw an angel standing in the sun, and he cried out with a loud voice, saying to all the birds which fly in mid-heaven, to come and assemble for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings, and the flesh of commanders, and the flesh of mighty men, and the flesh of horses, and those who sit upon them, and the flesh of men, both free men and slaves, and small and great. And I saw the beast, and the beast is the Antichrist, and the kings of the earth and their armies assembled to make war against him who sat upon the horse and his army. You see, when we're reading about this great city, there's something that comes before that, and that's this, at the end of the world, that's God, when Christ comes back, and the world is going to be a total, complete ecological disaster. And this is what it says in Jeremiah chapter 25. It says, a clamor has come to the end of the earth, because the Lord has a controversy with the nations. He is entering into judgment with all flesh, for as for the wicked, he has given them to the sword, declares the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, behold, evil is going forth from nation to nation. A great storm is being stirred up from the remotest parts of the earth. Now listen to this. Those slain by the Lord on that day will be from one end of the earth to the other. They will not be lamented, gathered, or buried, and they will be like dung on the face of the ground. Now, it says here, these people that are at war with God, and, you know, Christ is going to expunge every last drop of blood out of their veins. Well, it says here that this angel is calling birds from great distances from all around the world to devour their carcasses. And God says this, these rebels are going to be like dung on the face of the ground. Well, you could take that literally, because when your carcass is being devoured by beasts and birds, well, when they eliminate, it becomes dung. And that's what it says right here. It says here, they will not be lamented, gathered, or buried. They will be like dung on the face of the ground. I'm telling you, it really gets pretty heavy, and it gets pretty gruesome. But I'm telling you, this is what's going to happen before this kingdom or this city is established. All right, this city, even Abraham. Excuse me, it talks about it in Hebrews. You know, because it says about Abraham in Hebrews chapter 11. It says this. It says, by faith Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. By faith he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents, and with Isaac and Jacob, his fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. And then it goes on to say this, in that Hebrews, it says this, all these died. He's talked about, this is the faith chapter. It talks about all these people of faith. I don't care who it was. It, you know, it could have been Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all these different men of faith. And then it goes on to say, all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance, and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are not seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. You see, this is going to be the climax, is when he sets up this, you know, this new city. All right? And that's going to be where man is going to be dwelling with God. But you can find it all through the Bible in terms of what it's saying here. But there's coming a tremendous judgment upon the world and a tremendous judgment upon those who are at war with him. In this verse 7, it says, the east wind, you break up the ships of Tarshish. Now, the ships of Tarshish is believed to have been Spain, but there was a tremendous amount of wealth that was being brought in from the trade routes and from the sea and stuff like this. Well, so often people, they put money before God. They may not say that, but very often it's a very easy thing to do, to put money, to put material things, to put wealth, to put possessions, you know, to make it more important with God. But he's going to, it says here, there's a judgment coming for all this, all right? There's certainly nothing wrong with money, but I tell you what, if it's put in the place of God, it's going to come under judgment. He says in this verse 8, as we have heard, so we have seen. In the city of the Lord of hosts, in the city of our God, God will establish her forever. We have thought on your loving kindness, O God, in the midst of your temple. As is your name, O God, so is your praise to the ends of the earth. Your right hand is full of righteousness. Let Mount Zion be glad, and let the daughters of Judah rejoice because of your judgments. Walk about Zion and go around her, count her towers, consider her ramparts, go through her palaces that you may tell it to the next generation. For such is God, our God, forever and ever. He will guide us until death. And basically, just to distill it down to his barest essence is what he's saying here, is that this city is going to be established forever. This is going to be eternity. This whole universe, it's going to be wrapped up like a garment, and it's going to flee from the face of him who sits upon the throne. All right, people, they just think that this universe, this cosmos, is the only eternal reality, that it always was, always will be, always is. No, this is all going. All of it's going. And then, you know, this is where this whole thing is going to climax, you know. And this is the shame of it all is, too, because, you know, I was just sharing before the Bible study, suicide is becoming epidemic, isn't it? It really is. I don't care what category. I know in the military, it's going through the stratosphere. Everywhere you look, people are taking their lives. But you see, the real sad thing about that is that if people could understand that there's a future, that there's a hope, that there's an eternity, you know, mm-hmm. and there's a God who, if we can cast all of our cares upon him, it can make all the difference in the world. It really can. You know, and it's a real sad thing to see so many people taking their lives. But if they just had an understanding of, hey, man, there's a future.
That shows you how far our society is away from God, because a lot of them don't feel like they have any hope. It's like, what's the purpose?
Yeah. Well, you know what it says in Hosea chapter 4? It says, my people perish for what reason?
Lack of knowledge.
Now, quite frankly, I believe that it's primarily the dropping of the ball in the pulpit. Now, there are good pastors, ministers, and priests, but I'm telling you, I've never heard a sermon that deals with the second coming of Christ, the end of the world, and what's going to take place as far as the tribulation period and all of this stuff. And people, they're perishing for lack of knowledge. And I really think that people in the pulpit or, you know, Bible study teachers, whoever, you know, really need to emphasize that. But what's happening is God is getting crowded out more and more. He's getting crowded out. We still like to believe in God. You know, we look at him as being, you know, eternal butler or Santa Claus or, you know, just a mascot. But what's happening today is that Jesus Christ is no longer the center of all being. He's being crowded out with a humanism, with a secularism that's making man the center of all being. And more... the preaching today, the sermons today, the teaching today, very often it revolves around social justice issues. You know, everybody's trying to love one another and get along, and it doesn't matter what you believe and how you act. You know, we just need to be inclusive and tolerant and accepting, and oh, God, on and on and on. Well, when that happens, where's God? He's not the center. Man has become the center. And when that happens, you're going to see all of these things in regards to what we're experience today in this country. I don't care whether it's the suicides, whether it's the murders, whether it's you know, all the lying and cheating, the stealing, conniving. We got all, you know, just people are just, you know, at each other's throat, and all the racism and everything that's happening. Well, people don't realize, you know, why we're having all these problems, because we have not put the King where he belongs, in the center of our existence, in the center of all being. Instead, we're making man that center, and now look at the incredible, well, negative consequences of that, and we haven't seen anything yet compared to what's coming. But just the last couple of verses here, what he says this, he says, walk about Zion, go around her, count her towers, consider her ramparts. Now, what's a rampart?
The support of defense.
Yeah, that's what it is, a barricaded defense, a wall, a buffer, something. Mm-hmm. Well, in this city, it's just impregnable, and no one is going to enter this city who is not right with God. That's what it's talking about here. Consider her ramparts, go through her palaces, that you may tell it to the next generation. And that, this is the thing. We've really dropped the ball in terms of passing this baton off in terms of this knowledge of God. We really have, right? Back in the 1962, 63, we kicked them out of our schools, kicked them out of every place. You know, you can't even have a nativity scene set up without some jackass throwing a lawsuit at you. I mean, God has just been run out of everywhere. He really has. But the primary duty is the parents are the ones who have passed this on, because we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 4, Deuteronomy chapter 6, God said this, that when you get into this land, you get all these blessings that I give you, you got to beware in regards to, you know, if you have a full stomach, then you'll forget me. And he says the only antidote of not forgetting me, especially in your prosperity, is you got to read my word and study my word and meditate upon my word and share my word and talk about me to your kids when you rise up, when you walk along the way, when you're having a meal, when you go to bed at night. You see, but this has all been dropped. It really has. And that's the shame of it, is that we're not telling this next generation. And that's what I'm saying, too. That's another reason why people are just lost in space. I mean, they're just adrift, like right out there in the ocean. They're not anchored in anything, you know. And then when things get really tough, so many people are just taking their lives. And it's just a sad, sad thing. It really is. And he says that last verse 4, such is God, our God, forever and ever he will guide us until death. And I think some manuscripts, does anybody's Bible say that he will guide us forever?
Even to the end.
Yes, yes. That's what it really means, is he will guide us for all eternity. Now, that's a hope. That is a hope. And it's not some pie in the sky. It's not some fable or fairy tale or myth. This is real. It's just a shame that people don't see it. Right. And it doesn't mean if you have God the center of your life and you really revere and fear him, obey him, and have a relationship with him, that you're going to have a life without pain or suffering or setback or disappointment or anything like that. But you have a hope, and you have a purpose, and you have a direction, and you are anchored in something that is eternal, right? And that makes all the difference in the world. You know what I don't want to do? I want to quickly go through this chapter 49. It's not that long. But he says this in Psalm 49, he says, hear this, all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world. In other words, there's no exception here, right? He says, both low and high, rich and poor, together, my mouth will speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart will be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb, I will express my riddle on the harp. Why should I fear in the days of adversity, when iniquity of my foes surrounds me, even those who trust in their wealth and boast in their abundance of their riches? No man can by any means redeem his brother or give to God a ransom for him. For the redemption of his soul was costly, and he should cease trying forever, that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. For he sees that even wise men die, and the stupid and the senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others. Their inner thought is that their houses are forever, and their dwelling places to all generations. They have called their lands after their own names. But man in his pomp will not endure. He is like the beast that perish. This is the way of those who are foolish, and of those after them who approve their words. As sheep they are appointed for Sheol or for death, and death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning, and their form shall be for Sheol to consume, so that they have no habitation. But God will redeem my soul from the power of Sheol or death, for he will receive me. Do not be afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house is increased. For when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not descend after him. though while he lives, he congratulates himself, and though men praise you when you do well for yourself, he shall go to the generations of his father. They will never see the light. Man in his pomp, yet without understanding, is like the beast that perish. Now, the reason I read that whole thing, the whole 20 verses, is because there's a theme here, and it really it ties in well with what we just read in this chapter 48 of Psalms, and that's this. There's this eternity coming, and there's this city coming, and there's this new Jerusalem, and there's this coming the day when God is going to really deal with all unrepentant sinners, and then there's going to be a separation, all right? It's called heaven and hell. It's called the lake of fire and God's holy city, right? And this is what people need to understand. They need to zero in on this and really... It's certainly not like a laser beam. Hey, man, this life isn't where it's... To me, it's just not where our purpose lies, right? And he's bringing in this whole situation about people that are rich and people who are wealthy and people who are, you know, they put their confidence in their possessions and they have all these things. To do that, you're really being a foolish. That's why he says this in this verse 1, hear this, all peoples, give ear, all inhabitants of the world, both low and high, rich and poor together. In other words, this is a message for everybody, everybody. I don't care how rich you are, how famous you are, how popular you are, or how poor and pathetic you might be. This is a message for everybody, no exceptions. He says, my mouth will speak wisdom, and the meditation of my heart will be understanding. This is the wise man is going to really take this in consideration. What? The fact that, you know what? We're going to die. Then what? Then what? That's the wise man. That's why he's saying this. He says, my mouth will speak wisdom, and the meditations of my heart will be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will express my riddle on the harp. Why should I fear the days of adversity when the iniquity of my foes surround me? In other words, put everything in perspective, right? Even those who trust in their wealth and boast in the abundance of their riches. And, you know, he's talking about wisdom here, and wisdom... It makes all the difference in the world. What does it say in Proverbs about wisdom? It says this, wisdom shouts in the street. She lifts up her voice in the square. At the head of the noisy street, she cries out. At the entrance of the gates in the city, she utters her sayings. How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded, and scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge? Turn to my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit on you. I will make my words known to you. And now listen to this. Because I called, and you refused. I stretched out my hand, and no one paid attention. And you neglected all my counsel, and did not want my reproof. I also will laugh at your calamity, and I will mock when your dread comes. When your dread comes like a storm, and your calamity comes like a whirlwind, when distress and anguish come upon you, then they will call on me, but I will not answer. They will seek me diligently, but they will not find me, because they hated knowledge and did not choose the fear of the Lord. They would not accept my counsel. They spurned all my reproof. So they shall eat the fruit of their own way and be sated with their own devices, for the waywardness of the naive will kill them, and the complacency of fools will destroy them. But he who listens to me shall live securely and will be at ease from the dread of evil. And we were just talking about, you know, how important it is to get wisdom. It's the wise person who's going to look at life through the spectacles of death and realize that, you know, he's going to have to stand before God and account for God, and then he's going to make that preparation. That's the wise person. But what is it saying here, man? Wisdom calls in the streets. She's calling out all over the place, but people, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear it. They're too preoccupied with all these things. And it goes on to say in Proverbs chapter 3, wisdom, she is more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire compares with her. Long life is in her right hand, and in her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are pleasant ways, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her, and happy are those who hold her fast. And, you know, just backing up over here in that chapter 49, when it's talking about the wisdom here, he says, my mouth will speak wisdom, and my meditations in my heart will be understanding. I will incline my ear to a proverb. I will express my riddle on the harp. And this is the wisdom. The wisdom is this. You look at life, and you realize, you know what? This isn't where it's at. This is not where it's at. I don't care how rich and famous a person might be. I don't care what kind of struggles or difficulties a person might have to endure. This is not our home. This is not permanent. And he says, in verse 5, why should I fear the days of adversity when the iniquity of my foes surrounds me? Even those who trust in their wealth and boast in their abundance and of their riches. Now, These people, the Bible has a lot to say about the, you know, people who put all their faith and their hope and their trust in what? Their riches and their wealth. But when they start hoarding all this wealth, and when Jesus Christ is coming back with great power and great glory, what are people going to do with their silver and gold? What are we told they're going to do with it?
Throw it away.
We are told in Isaiah chapter 2, this is what it says. This is when Jesus Christ is returning. He's returning. When every eye sees him coming, great power, great glory, because the sun's gone out. And it only accentuates his return 100,000-fold because the sky opens up, the heavens open up, and they see him coming with the armies of heaven. And, you know, there's going to be two classes of people and only two classes of people. Those who are at war with him and they're trying to hide from him, yeah. And those who are going to have tears of joy just streaming down their faces saying, oh, praise God, hallelujah, here he comes. Here he comes. But this is what it says of people when they see him coming who have hoarded their gold and stuff. It says, enter the rock and hide in the dust from the chair of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased and the loftiness of man will be humbled as the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty and against everyone who is lifted up that he may be abased. And he goes on to say this. It says, the pride of man will be humbled and the loftiness of men will be abased and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. He's the King of Kings. And it says this, but the idols will completely vanish. Men will go into the caves of the rocks and into the holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to make the earth tremble. And that day men will cast away to the moles and to the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold which they have made for themselves to worship in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and into the clefts of the cliffs before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to make the earth tremble. And then he says this, stop regarding man whose breath of life is in his nostrils, for why should he be esteemed? And it ties in with what we were just reading. Oh, that's Isaiah chapter 2 in regards to what men are going to be doing with their wealth when they see. And as a matter of fact, Revelation chapter 6 deals with that same thing when it says this, when they see Jesus Christ coming in great power and great glory, it says this, and I looked, and when he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood, and the stars of the sky fell to the earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind, and the sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up. That's split apart like a scroll, and you're going to see heaven. You're going to see Christ coming. It says, and every mountain and every island were moved out of their places. Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall upon us and hide us from the presence of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand? You know, it's an interesting thing. During the tribulation period, probably about mid-trib, they're going to have, everybody's going to have, be required to have a mark, you know, on their forehead and right hand, and you're not going to be able to buy, trade, or sell without this mark. But it's interesting. It appears that silver and gold are still going to be commodities where you're still going to have that as a sense of monetary exchange. And what's interesting to me, I've read in a number of different magazines, including, I think, Fortune magazine, that people throughout the world today, in Europe and in America, what they're doing is they're buying gold and they're buying silver. They're buying it up. And guess what they're doing with it?
Burying it.
Hoarding it.
Yeah, they are really, believe it or not, they're hiding it in their houses, they're hiding it under floorboards, or behind their walls, or burying it in their backyard. I mean, you would think that that would be this, it's not, you would think it's the 1920s or 1930s, but they're hiding it. Why?
Because you're smart.
It's not safe in the bank.
Yes, it's not safe in the bank. You take that gold, you take that silver, you get yourself a safety deposit box and put it in the bank. The government's coming knocking. Hey, what's in there, man? We're gonna confiscate that. We're gonna tax it to no end or whatever. Ask Dan. He'll get his hands on it. right. So, well, I think the Bible is so right on here when it says what's going to happen there. And what did James say is going to happen to these rich people? What's going to happen to them? What did James say? Anybody remember?
Weep and moan.
Yes, he says here in James chapter 5, says, come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted, and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in the last days that you have stored up your treasure. In the last days. See what I'm saying? The last days, people are going to be hoarding silver and gold. And not only that, these are the last days. I'm absolutely convinced of it. These are the last days that the Bible has foretold. But it said, it's basically telling us here, you know what? The Bible predicts that there's going to be a multitude of very, very, very wealthy people in the last days. You know, I think when I was growing up, it was almost unheard of. You heard somebody was a millionaire. Now, people are millionaires, multimillionaires, they're billionaires. I mean, I'm not trying to put any of these people down, but I am saying this, man. They got a judgment coming for them if they put their money in the place of God. And Jesus Christ said very clearly, look, no one can serve two masters. You're either going to love one, hate the other, cleave to one, or despise the other. You cannot serve God and money, God and wealth, God and material things. And like I said, money, it can be a very, very, very good servant, right? But at the same token, it can really be a tyrannical master. And we are told by Paul and Timothy that money is the root of all sorts of evil. And I was mentioning this the other day as far as what a root is. A root is hidden life. You don't see it on the surface. You just do not see it. It's underneath. People may not even be aware that they have this inordinate love of money. But, you know, people do this. And look at the book of Daniel. Look at that chapter 5 where you read about Belshazzar. He's having this big drunken bash with all these nobles and all of his concubines. And then he decides, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to bring in all the utensils that we have stored in our warehouse that were taken out of the temple. So he brings in all these chalices and all these cups and all these utensils, and it wasn't because he was short on cups and plates. He just went out of his way to blaspheme the God of heaven. So he brings in all these things, they're all getting drunk and smashed and drinking out of these holy vessels, and then that hand comes out and writes, meeny, meeny, take a parson. But what's interesting about that, you read that, it says that they were drinking out of these cups and they were praising the gods of gold and silver and stone and brass and wood. They were praising these gods, right? And people say, well, that's the Old Testament, man. Get out of there. I mean, those people were ignoramuses. But I'll tell you what, this is what it says in Revelation, in chapter 9. When God brings one horrendous judgment after another, after another, after another, after another on this world to get men to repent. But it says this. It says, the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands, so as not to worship demons and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their immoralities, nor of their theft. See, nothing's changed, right? 1,000 years come and gone, and men still do this, see? They say, well, that was Belshazzar. Those people were ignoramuses. No, this is what's happening to us today. You know, when we're talking about riches and wealth and how people, you know, they put all their faith, they put all their confidence in their money. And that's going to be gone. This chapter 49, that's why it dealt with wisdom to begin with, because it's saying, hey, man, who's the wise person that really can see through a matter and see what really is lasting, what really is eternal? Because he says this right here, that verse 7, and that's Psalm 49. It says, no man can by any means redeem his brother or give to God a ransom for him, for the redemption of his soul was costly, and he should cease trying forever. Meaning, you know what? You can't buy your salvation. This very costly, it cost God his son, it cost God his every last drop of his blood, you know, to redeem us. But this is what Jesus Christ said. Remember what he talked about the rich fool, that he had this real huge bumper crop, and he said, man, what am I going to do? I know what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and I'll just then kick back, take my ease, and tell my soul, hey man, you have all this for years to come. And God says, thou fool, this night your soul is going to be required of you. And then, who are you going to leave all this to? I mean, when people, they do have money, or they do have wealth, Jesus Christ said, whoever has been given much, much will be required of him. But people, unfortunately, it was Jesus Christ said that, hey man, it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. This is why, you know, we have to really have enough wisdom to see what really matters in life, because it's so easy to, you know, get our focus on material things or money rather than to keep it on God. And he says in that verse 9 that he should live on eternally, that he should not undergo decay. That's, in other words, he's talking here about our souls, that the wise person can see what? He's going to see this, that he's going to live on eternally, right, and not undergo decay. He's going to be resurrected. In that verse 10, for he sees that even wise men die and senseless alike perish and leave their wealth to others, right? The wise man can see this, that both the righteous and the wicked are going to die, that both the wise men and the fool are going to die, but they're all not going to the same place. And it says in verse 11, their inner thought is that their houses are forever and their dwelling places to all generations. They have called their lands after their own names. In other words, this is what happens when people, they get very wealthy. Very often they have an ethic to just simply say, let's make money with money, and then more money with more money, more money with more money, and they accumulate all this wealth, and they're not given a second thought to the fact, hey, where's this all going to go? Look at Howard Hughes. He was probably the first billionaire in this country. And how did he live his life? Well, at the end, you know, he just basically went insane. He lived in his penthouse, and, you know, he had a phobia about germs, and he never shaved. I don't think he ever bathed. He let his hair grow, you know, completely matted, and his fingernails grow. And then when he died, he's, you know, who got all his money? All the lawyers all split it up, and the government got it, right? Now, there's a guy who could have done a lot for, you know, others with what he had, but his whole life became just so self-centered, you know. Yeah, but he's got a lot to account for. And at verse 12, but man in his pomp will not endure. He is like the beast that perish. In other words, people have to realize this, man, that we're all headed for the grave at lightning speed. The death rate is still one per person, and there's no exception. So then what? Then what? See, the wise person thinks about this. That's what Solomon says in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, that the wise person is the one that will go to a funeral parlor. He will go to a gravesite. He will dwell on death. The wise man thinks much about death, but the fool only thinks of having a good time. Where's the next party? What's the next get-together? But the wise man is saying, man, what's going to happen to me after I die? And, you know, I think I would encourage people to do this, because I've done it a number of times. It's just, especially if you're feeling down, and especially if you feel like the devil's beating on you, you've got all kinds of problems, go to a cemetery where nobody's around and just walk through the cemetery and just read the dates. Read the dates. Born such and such a date. Died such and such a date. Born such and such a date. Died such and such a date. And I read the obituaries virtually every day. You know, it's not because I'm morbid. It's because, man, I'm amazed at the number of people that I've known in my life who have now passed away. And we're all just headed there. And that's the big question. Where am I going to spend eternity? What's going to happen to me after I die? And that's what he says in verse 13. This is the way of those who are foolish, and of those after them who approve their words. As sheep, they are appointed for Sheol. In other words, Sheol applies to the grave, it applies to death, and it applies to hell. And it says, as sheep they are appointed for death, or the grave, or hell. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. And it says in the morning means that, you know, after the night's gone. And their form shall be for Sheol, or for the grave, or for death, or for hell to consume, so that they have no habitation. All right, they're not going to be in the city of God. They're not. But God will redeem my soul from the power of death, or the hell, or Sheol. For he will receive me. Why? Because you've made him your king. You've made him your king of kings, right? And you're obeying him. Because I just, back there in Revelation, you know, when they talked about this great city, they talked about this new Jerusalem. It says very clearly here that some people are not going to enter into it. Because in Revelation chapter 21, it says this, but for the cowardly, and the unbelieving, and the abominable, and the murderers, and the immoral persons, and the sorcerers, and the idolaters, and all liars, their part will be in a lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. And it goes on to say in chapter 22, it said, outside are the dogs, and the sorcerers, and the immoral persons, and the murderers, and the idolaters, and everyone who loves and practices lying. See, there's going to be this separation here. That's all there is to it. So that's why it's saying in this verse 16, and winding this down, this Psalm 49, do not be afraid when a man becomes rich, when the glory of his house is increased. For when he dies, he will carry nothing away. His glory will not descend after him. In other words, you can't take anything with you, man. I don't care how rich and famous you are, right? He says, though while he lives, he congratulates himself And though men praise you when you do well for yourself, he shall go to the generation of his fathers. They will never see the light. Man is pomp, yet without understanding, is like beasts that perish. I mean, that says it all, doesn't it? Winds it up. That there's a stark contrast between those who make Jesus Christ their king and those who just make themselves their God. And they put money before God or material things. And like I said, and the sad thing is, so many people, they just don't see this today. The devil's just got them blinded, that they are here for a purpose, that they have a glorious eternity before them. But the devil just blinds their eyes, and unless people can put God in the equation, and I don't mean as an afterthought, I mean in the center, because that's what I was talking about earlier, about man, the more we put mankind in the center, and the more man becomes the center of all being, that's humanism, that's secularism, yeah. And then we're going to have problems innumerable and problems unsolvable, and then in the end, we will have missed the whole point to our existence. Anybody have anything want to add or share?